Judiciary to order Tuesday, February 17th, 2011. We have a bill that we want to get into the process. Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 3204, 14-2011, be introduced as a
The Reverend Garrett has moved that LC draft 3204 dated 2/14/11 be adopted as committee bill. Is there any objections? And as always, if you vote for this, it doesn't mean you're going to support the bill. If it even gets a hearing here, you're free to do what you need to. If there's no objections, we'll adopt it as a committee bill.
All right, where do you want to start?
I think we'll start right at the top. That's one of her bills, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll open a public hearing on 2461.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2461, right now there's an existing prohibition on using public funds to pay for direct care if it's provided by a person who has any one of a number of different types of convictions, including person felonies, property felonies, and other. This would amend that list insofar as it would remove the conviction of theft in the first degree as a disqualifying offense, except in those cases where the conviction resulted in an enhanced sentence due to a judicial finding of regarding the vulnerability of the victim.
Representative Geltzer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for letting me come to visit you again. In past sessions, all of my bills have been sent to Representative Tomei's committee, and this session, it seems that all of my bills have been sent to your committee. So thank you for indulging hearings on so many of them. House Bill 2461 is a modest improvement to important legislation that we passed in 2009 to improve the safety of adults with developmental and physical disabilities and seniors and aging populations receiving direct care services. That legislation put into effect prohibitions on hiring as direct care providers individuals with certain crimes that elevated their risk to very vulnerable populations. It's very similar to what we do in the public school statutes in terms of who can be working in public school settings. The difference is that this list of crimes is vastly narrower than what is the case in public schools. At the time that we passed that law, I wanted to make sure that we were following what the how it was being implemented and who it was impacting. The Department of Human Services started to follow how many people were excluded from their direct care workforce. It turned out to be about less than 1% of those workers. We also wanted to see if there were certain crimes on that list that were picking up good care providers that we did not intend to pick up in this. And theft appeared to be one of those circumstances. I went back and talked with some defense attorneys and prosecutors about the idea of pulling this out. It was actually a defense attorney that suggested if we pulled it out, we should keep the exception of if that theft was committed against a vulnerable person, since the whole point of this was to protect vulnerable individuals. Mr. Knott pointed out to me just a few moments ago that there may need to be an adjustment in the statute that this references to ensure that it really is picking up theft and not just assault against a vulnerable person. But I do believe this is a good improvement to that bill. We certainly do not want to keep qualified care providers out of the workforce.
Questions?
And I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Representative.
Thank you. I'm not sure I heard you right. Did you say all your bills had been sentenced to this committee?
Hey.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Any other questions? Or is that one?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't do enough criminal law to know off the top of my head what a garden variety theft in the first degree actually is. I see Representative Hicks nodding his head over there. Maybe he can help me out.
Maybe counsel can.
Or counsel would be great. What's a garden variety theft in the first degree?
If you do this, you have to use less words than Hicks would have.
Co-chairs, members.
Too low a bar,
Mr.
Co-chair.
There are a variety of different kinds of theft in the first degree. The most common, and I think the one that would be implicated the most here, would be a theft of another person's property in an amount greater than
$1,000.
Okay. Thank you.
$1,000?
Follow up on that. It was $750 up until fairly recently, and that might govern some of those individuals who currently have that employment, but currently it's $1,000 or greater.
Any further questions?
Yeah. This is off the top of my head, but it's the unlawful taking of the property of another with the intent to permanently deprive. And there's several versions of that. I haven't weighed in. I wasn't necessarily going to, but I do. I am still thinking about this bill on one level. I don't want to sort of torpedo it or otherwise prop it up, you know, unduly. But I recall a case in particular that I prosecuted, a couple of addicts who worked at a residential care facility for persons with Alzheimer's and dementia, and they really wreaked a lot of havoc. They didn't have records. Well, one guy did have a record. One minor drug conviction. They didn't have records, but the amount of theft that they created was high. I think they each pled out to something like 22 of 43 counts. You know, the victim list was enormous. But that said, what they took was really what mattered more. I mean, they took one of our poor victims had a cross that was given to her on her confirmation in 1917. She'd worn her whole life. And so that's, I think, and I love the statute that you did last time around. I mean, that was an extremely good development, and so rolling that back is something we need to think about very carefully. There are people out there who have done the crime and, you know, done the time, but the statute was created for a reason. So, I don't know. I don't even, that's not really a question, but that's where I'm coming from on it so far.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes.
Go ahead. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, I appreciate those comments and share your commitment to maintaining the protections that we put into place for the most vulnerable Oregonians in 2009. I think what's different about this proposed statute is it does attempt to carve out someone that's coming to take that rosary or someone that's coming to take that very valuable personal property from a vulnerable individual. And what this was really intended to do was to make sure that vulnerable people were protected from people that prey on vulnerable people. The flip side might be someone who in college had shoplifted or had taken the parent's credit card and in multiple different transactions had hit that $750 or $1,000 mark. And then they're 45 years old, providing great care to their grandmother. I think that there was a compelling case that was made to me, and it was a pretty high bar to get me there, that we would not want those individuals to be precluded from providing that care to their loved ones.
Yeah, how that, if you're happy, I mean, that goes a long way toward, I mean, if you're satisfied having researched this as thoroughly as you have and been such an advocate, then that goes a long way toward helping me feel comfortable. It is, though, worth examining how the enhancement system does work, as counsel has sort of alluded to. When you charge something like vulnerable victim, it is based on the class of the victim. A person who's of advanced years oftentimes qualifies, or persons in other categories as well. The thing is, that's what the initial charging decision is, and that's what the person gets convicted of if they get convicted by a court or a jury. But again, I'm going back to how the criminal justice system works mantra that I keep going back on. You know, prosecutors do, for I think good public policy purposes, plea bargain. And one of the chips that, you know, we have in a situation where someone's been charged with accurately theft in the first degree, vulnerable victim enhancement, is to knock the enhancement for a plea. And so the actual conviction itself may not tell us the whole story, and I don't know of a way to get there through the statutory language of it. What the enhancement does, by the way, is, you know, theft one for a value of 1,000 to, I think, 5,000 is a one or a two on the grid, right? Two on the grid?
At over 1,000 is a 3. 750 was a 2.
750 was a 2, okay. Now that it's been bumped up, I think it's a... In any event, the presumptive sentence is 10 days of jail, unless you charge enhancement, like, goes up to 6 months.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, that's what the value of enhancement is, and that's why a person who's... And so I am a little bit wary of us missing a very critical piece of what happened in the past. So.
Okay, any further? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I apologize for a second comment on the same issue, but I am wondering if we might not get to what you're really driving at, either with a consideration of expungement or a time limitation of some sort. So we're driving at people that are serially dishonest, right? And you know, if a conviction is more than 10 years old and they haven't been convicted again, then maybe that's the type of person that we would want to lighten up the burden on a little bit. Type of limitation might be appropriate here.
Thank you. If I may, actually, expungement is already contemplated in the statute that we passed last session. If you have your record expunged, you can be hired. And that is really what creates that time frame. And the reason that we did it that way is the Department of Human Services has its own criminal background check unit, and they were doing a weight test on different crimes where they were applying the length of time. The problem was the individual that was the employer that was bringing this person into their own home, they might not know, they would not know particularly what those crimes were on that person's record to be able to make a judgment about whether they felt safe about that. And secondly, there is a workforce issue, so there's that issue of conflict of interest. How do I maintain a safe workforce, and how do I have adequate numbers of people to do that? So by putting that into the expungement process, you have a judicial system that is able to say, in the interest of justice, we're setting aside this conviction. This person has made restitution and is on a new path.
Okay, I think we're going to stop there. We'll go on forever. We have some ever. Public hearing on 2461, but go ahead and stay there because we're going to go out of order for a minute to get you done. You've got another one here.
I think that's two more.
Two more? You and Thatcher should get together. You'd run, you know, you could pretty well keep us busy. Let's go to 2940, and I'll open a public hearing on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eric Brewer is on the way, who is the chief co-sponsor of that bill, and I don't think that she has yet arrived. I'm happy to start without her.
Yeah, go ahead.
If that works.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2940 would make a modification to current ORS 163.187, which governs the crime of strangulation. The crime of strangulation is currently defined as a Class A misdemeanor carrying a maximum sentence of 1 year in jail. This bill would increase the penalty and severity of the crime of strangulation by making it a Class C felony and introduce repeat offenses for the crime of strangulation as an enhancement factor that would bring about a more serious sentence.
That's where 2940 is, not with these.
2940. This one.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm still Representative Sarah Gelser, representing House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. Representative Katie Eyre Brewer will be here soon, who's the chief co-sponsor of this bill. Those of you that have served on the Judiciary Committee in the past or have been here for the last several years will see that this is not a new bill. This is the continued question about how and when we are going to elevate the crime of strangulation to a felony. Many of my constituents or people that I talk to across the state are shocked to learn that in the state of Oregon, strangulation is actually a misdemeanor. This is a problem for two reasons. First, because it is a misdemeanor, it really minimizes the seriousness of the crime. And this is important because the seriousness of the crime needs to be impressed not just upon the perpetrator in these cases, but upon the victims. Strangulation is the most common form of violence used to control victims in situations of rape and domestic violence. And as you all know, victims of domestic violence are often reluctant for a variety of reasons to seek help and assistance. In the case of strangulation, by the time strangulation enters into the dynamic of a domestic violence situation, that is the leading indicator that that situation is going to end in a homicide. We also know that when, and for the case of this hearing, let's assume that this victim of domestic violence is a woman. There are men that are victims of domestic violence, and I want to acknowledge that, but I'm going to use the moniker she in this circumstance. But by the time a woman chooses to leave her abuser, that is the most dangerous time in her relationship with him. It is the time she is most likely to be killed. If you think about a woman who has been strangled and she goes to the police, she goes for help, under our current statute, that misdemeanor statute, he often isn't held for very long, if at all. This gives her no time to go and find a safer place to be, an undisclosed location to take her children in order to start her life anew or to get the assistance that she needs to transition into a safer, violence-free life. Strangulation is very difficult to charge as an assault because many times by the time the victim is able to get to law enforcement or get to a medical examiner, the fingerprints around the neck may have disappeared, and that makes it very difficult to prosecute it as a felony assault. This legislation is different than what you have seen in the past because we've worked very hard to get the fiscal down as low as we possibly can. This will cost a little bit of money. It will need to go to Representative Nolan's committee in Ways and Means because there will be some increased jail time. But I would submit that it is concerning to think about individuals who are perpetrating this type of violence and the risks that are inherent for their victims moving forward. The way that we have reduced the fiscal on this is to change where it goes into the sentencing grid. On the first offense, it goes in at a level 4, which means that you might actually, as a felony, have a shorter time that you might spend in jail or prison under this felony conviction than under a misdemeanor. But that still is a felony. It sends that message of it being a felony, and it gives the woman time in that initial incident. The other thing that's important is on a subsequent offense, it automatically bumps it up to a level 8, which is a much more serious, it's much more serious by the time you have a repeat strangler, and that is who we really want to get after. This is a very important piece of legislation. There are many knowledgeable people here today to talk to you about the medical impacts and the legal challenges that the current misdemeanor statute provides. I know that you are hearing another bill today on strangulation. And while that would be an improvement from where we are today, I firmly believe, and I think you will hear from the advocates, that they firmly believe that strangulation is a serious offense and it should be treated seriously and be recognized as a felony. And with that, I will turn it over to my friend and colleague, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Is this on?
Yeah.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. Just
for the record.
For the record, I'm Representative Katie Eyre Brewer. And I apologize for coming in a few minutes late here, but you know how that goes. I know most of you have heard this bill before in some form or another, but I wanted to personalize this a bit. Within 2 weeks of signing on to this with Representative Gelser, I received an SOS call from a very close family member who within about 12 hours had been beat up twice and strangled twice. And while on the phone with this person, I was able to get her, talk her out of how to get out of the house safely and get to the ER. And I only hung up the phone with her so that she could call 911, and they met her at the hospital. They documented the bruising all over her body, but the most startling and heartbreaking was actually seeing the fingerprints from bruising on her neck. I want to personalize a little bit about what strangling really is. When someone strangles a victim with their hands, they use one or two hands on their neck, and they apply sufficient pressure for a very long period of time with two goals in mind. One is restraint, and the second is to cut off their air supply. Now, beyond that, think about this. When someone strangles you, they have to do it at arm's length or closer. And it is face to face with the victim. It is eye to eye with the victim. And as they apply that pressure, very intense pressure, for a very long period of time, they are able to look into the very eyes of their victim as that victim struggles for just one more precious gasp of air. To me, that sounds like a felony. And to that victim, it feels like a felony. So I urge you to pass this with a due recommend to the House floor. Thank you. Do pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is subject matter that makes people probably reluctant to be on judiciary, this kind of subject matter. But my personal solution to all this is, well, I've been told it's illegal, unconstitutional. Some think it's inhumane, but it's incredibly effective. But my question, I actually do have a question. It says in the explanation up to $125,000 fine, but I don't see that number in the language. Is it established by some rule somewhere? Well, that is the Class C felony fine. Okay. Thank you very much.
Maximum fine.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Any other further questions?
Okay.
No, I will chime in, actually.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks?
I just want to add one more thing, not to detract from the very dramatic representation of strangulation, but from the criminal justice system perspective, I will say that proving a case involving strangulation where one victim has been strangled and the other hasn't is helped. Because strangulation is virtually never done by someone who is acting in self-defense. And oftentimes, when there's only two people, which is a domestic violence situation, there's only two people there, it's he said, she said, and so you have to look at the circumstantial evidence, which you can objectively prove, oftentimes, you know, with the telltale marks that strangulation is notorious for. And if they're both accusing each other of attacking, well, strangulation tells the rest of the story. So that's the utility of it in the domestic violence arena. Thank you.
Thank you.
And just briefly, we've tried this bill, as you know, in the past, and we're trying it once again. And my family works closely with the Yolanda shelter in Portland, and they have begged me, the people, the staff there have begged me time after, ever since we've been starting there, please make that a felony, because they have the women who are escaping by the skin of their teeth and getting into those shelters.
And so
they consider it to be violent. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have Steve, is it Belshaw? Christine Herman and Sarah Brennan, please come up.
Just identify yourself.
Start in any order you want.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger. My name is Steve Belshaw. I'm the Deputy Chief of Police for the City of Salem Police Department. I have supervised our Criminal Investigations Division and our Domestic Violence Response Team. I've been involved in investigating violent crimes against women and children for over 20 years. In the last 2 years, the Salem Police Department has investigated over 150 incidents of strangulation. My officers have talked to victims that I'll introduce you to today, but the names have been changed to protect their identity. We met Brandy, who was punched in the head repeatedly by her boyfriend for not getting dressed quickly enough so they could go out to dinner. He then placed his hands around her throat for 5 to 10 seconds, strangling her until she thought she was going to black out. He repeated this 15 to 20 times. She can't remember how many. She lost count. He repeated this process then with an electrical cord around her neck, and she felt woozy and thought she was going to puke. He let her go, saying, "Now you know I can kill you." My officers interviewed Elena, who separated from the father of her children. When she met Ricky in the parking lot of Big Lots store to get money for diapers, he demanded to know when she would let him move back in. When she told him that wasn't going to happen, he strangled her until she vomited all over herself in the parking lot. We met Lisa, who was strangled by her boyfriend while holding her six-week-old son in her arms. She told the officer she felt lightheaded and her vision was blurry, but she knew she could not pass out because if she fell, she would injure her son. We met Sue, who was 5'6", 130 pounds. Who was strangled by Ryan, her boyfriend, 6'2", 225 pounds, who got up off of her and said, "Now you know I can kill you and nobody would miss you." Please understand that putting your hands around another person's throat is not a sign of affection, it's not romantic, and it's not foreplay that leads to a more intimate encounter. It is simply to control another person's behavior and to show you are in a position of control and strength and dominance. It's not choking, which is when you accidentally get something lodged in your airway. It is a conscious action on the part of one person exerting power and control over another person. Understand, strangulation is not like in the movies, where someone sits on the chest of another and exerts great pressure on their throat. approximately 10 pounds of pressure on the carotid arteries can lead to unconsciousness in 10 seconds. 30 pounds of pressure on the airway will lead to unconsciousness within a minute, and death can occur within 4 minutes. The average male has approximately 126 pounds of pressure in their dominant hand and 25 pounds of pressure between their thumb and forefinger. The act of strangulation is a crime. It is dangerous and a potentially deadly crime that occurs in our state daily. This is not a crime for which a person should receive a citation or be sentenced to probation. We need to send a clear message that this is not acceptable and that there will be meaning consequences to your criminal actions.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, my name is Christine Herman. I'm with the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force, and I am here in support of House Bill 2940. I believe that a lot of the points have been made by the folks that have spoken before me. What I do want to just point out is that that while strangulation is obviously something that we see all too often in domestic violence cases, it's also something that's very common in sexual assault cases. Approximately 16% of sexual assault victims report strangulation as a part of the sexual assault itself. I also just want to contrast for you what strangulation currently is in our criminal law in comparison to other crimes. As a misdemeanor, a Class A misdemeanor, strangulation is currently treated the same as theft in the third degree, which could be theft of property worth $55. It's also treated the same as passing a bad check. Although, if you pass your second bad check, that's a felony. Current law does not recognize that for strangulation. The House Bill 2940 recognizes that this is a felony activity and should be treated as such. It also realizes the state of our economy and starts it out, like Representative Gelser said, as a level 4 offense. So a pretty modest amount of jail time on the first offense. The second offense, if somebody comes back with a second strangulation, then he's going to see significant prison time, which is appropriate. Thank you for considering this and for your continued support of this concept, and I do urge you to vote to pass this on to the House floor.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Beth Brennan, and I am a victim service advocate at Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service has been serving Marion County, much like Yolanda House in Portland has. We've actually been serving victims of domestic and sexual violence for 38 years. And we're here to speak today on behalf of those survivors and talk about the importance of House Bill 2940. You've heard a lot of great testimony, and I just want to stress how important it is that we take a stand in our state and show that our laws recognize strangulation as important. Right now, hearing that the law is classified a misdemeanor, it somehow seems less serious. And the fact is, when I have women on the phone who are calling and telling me his hands ended up around my neck, I'm often the person that has to explain to them how dangerous it is and how even hours later they can have additional swelling that could cause complications or even death. And I am guessing that even like once a week, I am urging a woman to go and get help at an emergency room because strangulation is unfortunately that common. We feel it's a very important change to Oregon law and recognizes a very lethal behavior for what it is. I think as legislators, you have a great opportunity to take a stand on this issue and send a clear message to Oregonians that strangulation is a serious crime, and I urge you to support this bill. And thank you for your time.
Any questions, committee? Yes, Representative Garrett?
Maybe this is for Christine, but it could be for any of you. I wonder if you know how this is treated in other states' criminal codes. We have before us two different approaches to this issue. I can see pros and cons of either. I'd love to know what, you know, perhaps there's a reason why our statute was written the way it was that I haven't been informed of, but how is this dealt with in other states?
Co-Chairs, Representative Garrett, thank you for that question. I don't have an exact number of states that treat strangulation as a felony, although somebody else who signed up to testify may in fact have that. What I can say is that the experience that I've had in other states is that it's treated as the felony crime that it is, or that there are assault statutes that are written in ways that would allow the activity of strangulation to be charged as a felony assault, even if it's called something else. I don't also know the reason, of course, why this state initially classified strangulation as the low-level crime that it is. But if I were to guess, and I am going to, it may have been just a misunderstanding of the activity. It's taken time for us to realize that what seems to be a simple act can be lethal in such a short amount of time. And so it may just be an example of how our laws are trying to catch up with our knowledge.
Okay, anything further? Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
There are four people left, so I'm going to bring them up two at a time. Shannon Seville and Sybil Hebb, please.
Mr. Chair, can we get our committee administrator to answer Representative Garrett's question, how many states have this level of...
I believe we got probably someone that can testify
thank you.
To that. Proceed.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Barker, members of the committee, Shannon Seville from the Oregon Department of Justice. I actually can answer that question, and perhaps Sybil can as well. I believe according to the National Institute of Justice Journal, 27 states currently have strangulation and felony, and my understanding is that there are at least a handful of other states that are currently considering elevating strangulation to a felony at this time. I've covered nearly everything. I just want to briefly state that the Department of Justice worked closely with Representative Gelzer in crafting this bill. We strongly support the bill, and we very much hope that Oregon will become another place that recognizes the severity of the crime. One statistic that I recently read was that domestic violence victims who are strangled are 9 times more likely to be killed, and I think that pretty much says it all. So I very much urge you to pass the bill.
Before we go on, I think Representative Garrett had a question. Why don't you go ahead and get that done?
Shannon, the 27 states, do they make it a felony in every instance, or is it more intricate than that, only in certain circumstances?
It may be more intricate. I'm not positive, but I believe that actually Deputy DA Gina Skinner, who's in the audience and will be testifying next, hopefully, actually can provide you some more detail.
Okay. Sybil?
Members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of House Bill 2940, and appreciate your attention to this issue and the attention of the sponsors to this issue over many years now. I echo the comments and appreciate all the comments of those who have come before me, and the pieces that I would just add are that we know nationally that that strangulation is the result of 10% of all of our homicides as a nation. In Oregon, last year, 13% of domestic violence homicides were as a result of strangulation. So we're seeing this on the ground regularly, unfortunately. The only other comments I would add are that as we have developed a growing understanding of the lethality of this behavior, and Mr. Belshaw testified that it used to be commonly referred to as choking, and people, I think, victims, advocates, systems responders, the community didn't understand fully the lethality of strangulation. And I think that is why states previously mostly had identified it as a misdemeanor. The trend over the past few years has been to identify it as a felony, and now there are 27 states that do, in fact, treat it that way in certain circumstances or in all circumstances, depending. There's a study done after the passage of Minnesota's most recent felony strangulation bill. And that study was conducted after the bill had been in effect for 3 or 4 years. And what it found was that there was a heightened awareness amongst advocates as well as the general public and system providers about the severity of this crime. And one judge, there are a number of different comments that were submitted in response, and one judge commented that, in his opinion, passage of the law had made a great improvement in terms of how law enforcement, prosecutors, victim advocates, and victims themselves were understanding the lethality of the behavior and responding appropriately. So we think that passage of this bill here in Oregon will have a similar impact and really appreciate your attention to this issue.
Thank you. And I know children are persons, but I just want to make sure this includes children too, right? Somebody strangles a child. Is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Further?
I don't know if you can answer this, but thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you think this would be a deterrent if it were a more serious crime?
Chair, as the recommendation may. My opinion is yes, that it would be a deterrent. I think that society as a whole doesn't recognize, tends to minimize the behavior, and everything that we can do to make it clear that it is very lethal behavior, it's very serious behavior, and it will be treated that way, helps. And so creating it as a felony and calling it what it is, a very lethal behavior, that helps, and that sort of translates across systems providers and the general public as well.
Thank you. And if I could just do a follow-up, if anybody could give me some material about that from the states where it is already a felony, if it's been a deterrent, that would be really good information for me. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
I think this is going to be truly effective, and maybe for a little bit more of a nuanced reason. And the reason is, again, going back to how the justice system works, you know, you charge a felony strangulation, the victim would come in, testify before the grand jury, probably still have the marks, the telltale marks. They're probably going to get an indictment. It's going to get handed down, true bill. Well, then we go into the plea negotiation phase with the domestic violence cases is oftentimes very difficult because people are living their lives at the same time as these criminal cases are going on, and there's a lot going into, you know what I mean, and there's a lot going into this stuff. And so we do need to get the situation addressed and fairly in as short order as we can because families are, you know, living at stake. And what the state can now do, if it deems appropriate on a case-by-case basis, is offer to drop it down to a misdemeanor, get the conviction, get the offender in treatment, DV treatment, which is boilerplate, for these types of kids. You know what I mean? This is what's going to happen. And this is why it's going to be a huge deterrent. Is that making sense? I mean, that's what we're doing. And so because this is such a domestic violence-focused crime, I think this is really going to make a difference.
Thank you.
Talking to staff, you know, this, as we know, this has died before in Ways and Means, and this is going to be, I think, crucial that we're able to show that the deterrent effect may cause future crimes and things of this nature to be less in number. So there's a certain saving there. Sometimes trying to quantify what that is where we run into problems. But we need to have that available in the way, at least in the Ways and Means people, because we're probably going to move this out, believe it or not. And that's what we're going to have to put up with. We probably referral to Ways and Means, and we're going to have to be able to show that maybe talking to the people that are doing the impact statement as they're doing it, not afterwards, try to convince them. You know? And Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and that actually leads to one of the points I wanted to see if I could fine-tune the request that Representative Tomei made. Specifically, it would be very helpful, although, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm not sure it is a necessary condition, since I'm looking at two of the other people on the Public Safety Subcommittee, but it would be very helpful if we could have an analysis of the deterrent effect 3 to 5 years after a state made a move similar to this. If you have states that made this change 5, 6, 7 years ago and you can give us information about what happened in those states, it would be enormously helpful for us.
And Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, the Department of Justice is also working with the individual district attorney's offices to get accurate numbers regarding how many times they charged the offense of strangulation in the last year, and of those cases, how many times it was the most severe crime. Because that's what's going to really also give us an accurate read on what the change would be if it's a felony, how many of those would possibly go to trial, what the increase in the fiscal would be. So we'll hope to have those numbers very shortly. In fact, we have, I think, over half the counties now because of Elizabeth Kirkwood. So we're working on that.
Anything further? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Let's have Gina Skinner and Gail Meyer come up, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, co-chairs Barker and Krieger.
My name is Gina Skinner, and I am a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I have been a deputy district attorney for going on 14 years now, and I've specialized in prosecution of domestic violence and stalking cases for the entire time I've been doing this job. I can also tell you that I was one of a few people that worked with Senator Brzezinski back four sessions ago to draft this original bill. And I can tell you that at the time, the plan was for it to be a felony. We recognized at that time how serious and how dangerous and how lethal this is, and we brought in a significant amount of testimony to share our concerns about this action and the crime itself. And at that time, because of the fiscal, we were told that we had two choices. It could be a misdemeanor or it could be nothing. And so at that time, we chose to go with a misdemeanor with the hope that down the road that we would eventually be able to get all the parties together and understand the seriousness of this and elevate it to a felony if under certain circumstances or under all circumstances. And this will be the fourth session that I've testified on this bill or on this bill similar to this. And every year I come back hoping that it will be the year that we will make that change and we will move forward. I've provided copies to the committee regarding one sheet is a fact sheet that just has some general statistics and information about strangulation generally and how lethal the action is. The other one is information that was compiled regarding all 50 states. In anticipation of this bill being dropped again in the session last summer, some people in my office, we worked together to get this information compiled for you. So this is as good as of the end of last summer. But it does go through and document state by state in all 50 states what the law is regarding strangulation and whether or not it is classified as a felony or not. If there is any additional information regarding that, I'm more than happy to research that and provide that information to you. I don't feel at this point that I need to convince all of you that strangulation is I think that most people are in agreement, and I can say that every time I've testified on this bill, that has been the consensus. So some of the issues that I want to be able to answer any questions the committee may have regarding this crime itself or the prosecution of it, the sentencing or the cost. Some of the things I wanted to point out, though, is one of the benefits to making this a felony was addressed briefly, but the issue of training police officers. I've also been teaching the domestic violence class at GPPST for the last 11 years, and strangulation has not really been a focus of what they do there. They tend to focus on the mandatory arrest crimes, which in Oregon currently are only assault and menacing. This is not even on that list. And as many of you know who have been around for a long time, DUII also did not used to be considered very serious, and there wasn't a lot of effort put into police training on that issue as well. And I'm sure that you've seen amazing on all the time and effort and detail that's put now into police officer investigations. That's because our legislature has increased the penalties. It's now a felony after the third offense, and so those investigations and training significantly improved, and I believe that if this crime becomes a felony, the same thing will happen as far as the focus and the energy and the effort that's put in by police officers into documenting, investigating, and ultimately successfully getting a prosecution in these type of crimes. The other thing I wanted to point out, and this somewhat addresses Representative Nolan's question about the deterrent effect, is that currently, as a misdemeanor, those cases upon conviction, the state of Oregon does not pay the individual counties to supervise people that are convicted of a misdemeanor crime. The counties are only paid to supervise felony convictions. And in some counties that have the independent funds from their own county, they can afford to choose to supervise misdemeanor people convicted of misdemeanors. But in most counties, they can't, and they don't. And so these people are not being supervised with a probation officer. So I can imagine that the deterrent effect would be significant upon a felony conviction where all of these people that are convicted of felony strangulation would have a probation officer, would be on supervision, and would be monitoring their success. And I would imagine that could most likely would significantly reduce the likelihood of reoffense and the likelihood of their being successful on probation, which ultimately would be to change their behavior, to not repeat this activity down the road.
And since it is a level 4 on the first offense, we are looking at a mandatory, the sentence would be probation across the board, unless they were had an A or a B on the guidelines, and they still wouldn't go to the Department of Corrections. It would still be local jail time. And so they would not be looking at even going to the Department of Corrections unless you had a second conviction, and that would be, that would really be a significant offense, and they should go to the Department of Corrections if that were to occur. The only thing I did want to add, and I just mentioned it briefly, but was that I would suggest that this be added to the mandatory arrest statute, which it currently is not on, if we are going to consider this to be as serious as it is, and that's ORS 133055. And I'm happy.
Okay, go ahead, Gail, and when you're done, we'll have questions.
Thank you. Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, thank you. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I don't want my comments, please, to be misunderstood. We do not quarrel with the severity and the gravity of the conduct that's being at issue here and that these fails, and we don't quarrel with anyone who has a shared interest for providing increased need for people at risk of this. There's two features of the bill that I simply want to bring to the committee's attention for consideration. And it might answer, perhaps, Representative Garrett's your question of really, too, what was behind part of the thinking in making this an A misdemeanor at the outset. Ms. Skinner provided feedback that largely it was fiscal. But also, just to point out to the committee, the criminal code attempts as best as it can to calibrate the crime severity rating of like crimes to like crimes. So this is similar to assault-related crimes. And in the world of assault, we go from assault 1, 2, 3, and 4. Assault 4 is your A misdemeanor. Assault 4 does require physical injury. And the definition of physical injury is actually quite substantial. It's impairment of a physical condition or substantial pain. If you don't have physical injury, then your next related assault crime would be a harassment, which is a mere B misdemeanor. So initially, when strangulation was created, it does not require physical injury. So it requires the pressure or the impeding of the flow of breath or circulation of the blood, but it does not require physical injury. So it's already elevated beyond its equal calibration in the assault crimes, and to aggravate it yet again up to felony, still without requiring physical injury, is yet another bump. I know we're talking about House Bill 2940, but I do observe House Bill 2971 doesn't elevate it to an C felony in all instances, but only in certain circumstances, and one of the enumerated circumstances is if there is physical injury with the strangulation. So that would sort of keep the calibration more equal. I would also want to point out a feature as to the definition of a previous crime. It would go from a Category 4 on the guidelines to Category 8 if there had been a previous conviction. Testimony that had been given prior to this, Representative Gelser mentioned about something about getting out and doing it again. And if what the committee intends to do is to make it a Category 8 for those offenders who have committed this crime, had an intervention and a punishment, and then committed a second crime again, this bill doesn't quite say just that. It needs to have some additional language. It needs to say specifically that a previous conviction means a conviction that was entered prior to the time of the commission of the current offense. I point that out to the committee. It's your choice as to what you mean. It could also curtail the fiscal if you were to narrow it in that way.
Okay, committee members, any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So, Gail, help me understand in the, number 2 of your material here, you talk about requires physical injury, and in the last line there, greater degree of harm and injury than does a felony crime. So help me, does that mean evidence of physical injury? Is that what you mean? Because we're hearing that sometimes there is no evidence, there are no bruising, et cetera, so no outward evidence of physical injury.
Chair Barkers and Krieger and Representative Tomei, I wish I brought my written comments up here with me. the presence or lack of presence of physical injury right now under strangulation is not an issue. To prosecute right now for strangulation, you do not need to show physical injury.
Okay.
My only comment is that if you're, when you're talking about recharacterizing the severity rating of a crime, I just point out to the committee, you're losing your calibration as it relates to existing assault statutes. Existing assault 4, which is also an A misdemeanor, does require physical injury. And so by elevating strangulation, which does not, to a C felony, creates that skewing lack of calibration between the crime levels. It may be what this committee wants to do. I simply point out that feature.
Thank you.
This is one of those areas in which there's always going to be some light between the defense and the prosecution. But I mean, I do argue that that strangulation does, I think, inherently involve physical injury under the definition that the legislature and the statutes have provided. I'm looking at the definition of physical injury, which is 161.015. Physical injury means impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. Strangulation is knowingly impeding, it's the same word, basically, impairment or impeding the normal breathing or circulation of the blood of another person. Well, breathing and circulation are a physical condition, and so we have physical injury and strangulation basically having near matching definitions. And so I, you know, have often, and I think counsel and I have kind of seen this one the same, perhaps, you know, it's also arguably an assault 4. It's an assault at the same time, and we could almost charge strangulation as an assault, which is in 163.160, which is, you know, an equal level of crime. And that's where I'm bringing this around, I will actually ask for comment, is in terms of the bill that you've referenced here, House Bill 2971, kind of the alternative bill, and looking down the Section 4 of that bill, we have a number of sort of mitigating factors that would bump this up to felony instead of just being, you know, assumed. I mean, we have A, which says the crime was committed in the immediate presence of or is witnessed by the person's or victim's minor child. I mean, that's assault for a felony already. So we could already charge that there's no change involved. B, the person used or attempted to use a dangerous weapon, that's assault too. So we're moving into Measure 11 there, because, again, we have the physical injury. So that's the kind of thing we could charge, probably, justifiably, you know, already as a felony. Three, the person caused physical injury to the victim during commission of the crime. Again, we're already able to charge that, I would argue, you know, under the current definition of assault. And you see where I'm going with this. And so I'm going all the way down the list, and I'm not seeing that the proposal in this bill would actually change really anything from what the state is able to charge. You following what I'm saying? And I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Thank you. Chairs Krieger and Barker and Co-Chair Hicks. Firstly, I would say, I think, I hope to confine my thinking clearly here. Very frequently, my practitioners are telling me that they do frequently find indictments or charging instruments with both counts, assault 4 and strangulation. And very frequently the debate is one requires physical injury, the other one does not. And I think we could argue whether impairment of a function is the same thing as impeding, but be that as it may. With respect to 2971, I would suggest that it does mirror the existing calibration that we have in our assault statutes, because again, assault 4 does become a felony under the circumstances if you've just identified, if it occurs in the immediate presence of the children in the home, and if there are a sufficient number of prior convictions. So I just observe that when you're calibrating, when you're classifying crimes, there's a certain logic that's present in our assault statutes. And then this is on sort of a separate track. And it may be consistent with what this committee wants to do. But I just point out that I think House Bill 2971 tracks many similar features that are existing in our assault crimes, and it may choose to want to maintain similarity in these crimes as well.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate what you're saying with regard to tracking similar crimes and making them in a horizontal basis somewhat the same, but I think from my perspective that we've already decoupled strangulation from the assault regime by creating an entirely separate category for it in and of itself, and so that's less persuasive to me. I think I understand your policy. I think you're right. I mean, that is the way that we categorize crimes. At least that's what I remember from law school a long time ago. But again, I just think the policy was already set a few sessions ago when they separated strangulation out. So thank you very much.
This is just a question that came to me as you're talking about the definition of strangulation. Hypothetically, let's say you have a bar fight, two guys, one puts his hand on the other's neck and squeezes for a couple seconds. Does that now become a felony under this bill? Is that the definition of strangulation?
Chairs Barker and Krieger, Representative Garrett. It isn't so much the fact that he just put his hand on the neck. It would have to impair the breathing or impede the breathing or the blood circulation. And so it would come down to that particular victim articulating that, in fact, that person was knowingly doing that, and that ultimately was the result. You know, in a situation like that, you very well may have one party being able to have a claim of self-defense that they may legitimately be able to argue that could be successful, but there isn't anything about this bill that makes it specific to domestic violence. I mean, it could be between strangers or somebody in a bar, but if there is a person in a bar or in a movie theater or any place else that goes to another person and puts their hand around their neck and makes it so that they can't breathe with the sufficient force that it impairs their ability to breathe. The idea about the blood circulation is because after 11 seconds, you're going to pass out if your jugular veins are closed. And so that's why we have that continuity of language. But if that happens, it shouldn't really matter who that person is who's doing the action. So, yes, it would fall under this category of crime.
Follow-up. Yeah, I understand it's not limited to the DV cases, and there's no doubt that I understand that's the bulk of what we're talking about, and there's no doubt about the severity of that. But since the definition of strangulation and impeding airflow, or whatever the word is, doesn't make any reference to length of time, it seems like even if it's for a fraction of a second, you're within the definition of strangulation, and at least theoretically, understanding that's not the reality we're probably talking about, but at least theoretically, I think we're creating a potential to charge a felony in cases where we have that type of scenario, where it's a very brief, even a fraction of a second, hands around a neck situation.
Representatives Barker and Krieger, Representative Garrett, the idea initially from the beginning was that there was a discussion about should we put a number on how many seconds that this should be. And from the beginning, the agreement was that would not be, it doesn't, that wouldn't be helpful because to each person, that might be a different amount of time that would impede that person's ability to breathe. That they feel scared enough that they would contact law enforcement, that someone would call 911, that they felt that they needed to initiate that process. And, you know, I could imagine scenarios like that where law enforcement was never involved because it was resolved amongst themselves. And so that would be something that concerned parties, as you know, since it is a felony, these cases are all going to go to a grand jury someplace, and that other citizens are going to review those facts and decide if they feel that does sufficiently impair somebody's ability to breathe to a degree that it would.
As a final point, Mr. Chair, I just as a comment, I wonder if that is what has caused Representative Jensen to propose his alternative bill. Maybe it is to try and recognize at least that theoretical distinction.
Chairs Barker and Krieger, Representative Garrett, the underlying definition is the same. I mean, the crime of strangulation isn't being altered in any way, and so the crime that is defined in both of these bills are exactly identical. The only thing that is different is that in House Bill 2940, the initial bill, the initial crime would be a felony, and then it was an effective sentence. The other one, they're saying that under certain circumstances, like if there's a child present, if a weapon was involved, other circumstances like that, it would elevate the crime to a felony. But we'd have the same circumstance. You have a bar fight with an assault four, and if it impacted any of the four categories of a crime, that it would elevate that to an assault four. Now, it's unlikely to be in a bar because it'd have to be a child there, but if it was on the street and one person is male, assaulted another male, and they have there with their kid, that would be a felony. And so that same facts could occur.
Okay, staff, you had a comment?
Thank you, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. This is a question about the enhancement, the repeat offender, and the circumstances under which it goes from level 4 to level 8. Mm-hmm. I note that one of the distinctions between your bill and House Bill 2971 is that 2971 looks at a number of different charges as possible enhancement. Of course, they set the bar a little bit differently, but assault in the second degree, third degree, fourth degree, even menacing, would be included as a basis for imposing a more severe sentence. And it seems, and for yours, it's just strangulation. It seems like that could set up a scenario where someone is, even the same victim, has been previously brutalized by something more severe than strangulation, say an assault two, something that's causing permanent injury. And maybe that was even strangulation-type conduct, but she was being strangled, say, with an iron bar instead of with hands, and it caused permanent injury. And then at the resulting plea bargain, they pled to the assault, and the strangulation was dismissed. So I suppose I'm curious why only strangulation would count as a predicate offense to get you to a level 8.
Chairs Krieger and Barker, counsel not. I was not involved in actually writing this. You'll have to ask Representative Gelser about the specifics. I would venture a guess that it was to reduce the cost. In a perfect world, and one of my notes on this is that if I were writing it, I would have added assault four and menacing to that list of priors that would then elevate it, but I would imagine that the reason it was done that way is so that it would be a less number of cases and that we're really narrowly focusing on the offenders who strangle. My experience has been, and the statistics bear out, that when domestic violence offenders commit strangulation, whether they've actually been adjudicated for that, but they just do the action, they are much more likely to repeat that action over and over again, whether it's against that victim or subsequent victims, and we ultimately know that that can be extremely lethal. And so focusing so narrowly on something that is apples and oranges to assault, because it's so dangerous and so close to murder that most, I imagine that that's the reason it was narrowed to that particular crime. But as I indicated, you'll have to ask Representative Gelter for the specific reason.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we talk about this, I'm interested in, we talked with the previous panel about the potential deterrent effect of this legislation. I'm interested in your experience as a deputy DA on whether there are effective tactics for deterrence, not just or for reducing the grievous behavior, whether it is deterrence through criminal statute or through other kinds of preventative treatment, post-conviction programs.
Chairs Rucker and Krieger, Representative Nolan, talking about deterrence is a difficult idea when you're talking about domestic violence, because you're trying to identify and count something that hasn't happened, and so that's always a difficult concept. You know, is the reason that it's not reported again, is the person hasn't been arrested again because the victim stopped reporting because they're so scared of this offender? Has the victim left and the defendant has now moved to a different jurisdiction and so they're out of our purview? There's a lot of variables that we don't have a lot of control over. Currently, the idea is that law enforcement involvement is the first and foremost, most important aspect. When speaking with victims that have since had their case adjudicated, you ask them, at the time you didn't want the offender arrested, looking back now, would you, and almost all of them will agree that that was the most important thing, was getting law enforcement involved. This is not something that offenders are going to stop on their own, and they are going to continue until someone that has more power than them tells them to stop. And so once law enforcement is involved, then having, as a first, I guess, tact, is putting them on formal probation with some very significant parameters, and that would include batter intervention treatment. Currently in Oregon, the Senate Bill 81 from many sessions ago mandates a 52-week batter treatment program that all offenders have to complete. And that was what I had mentioned previously about making all of these a felony would then statewide these offenders. First offense would, for the most part, all be on formal probation. They would have a formal probation officer who would make sure that they're going to those classes. They would make sure that they are not drinking when they're not supposed to be, that they're doing parenting classes, that they can do home visits and make sure that they're, you know, if they're not supposed to be having contact with the victim, that they're not. And that in itself is the best chance that we have a reformation and the best chance that we have at giving them an opportunity to change their behavior and to, you know, to be that good husband and that good father. And the idea is that if after multiple opportunities working with their probation officer, if they are unsuccessful and continue this behavior, then at that point the deterrent effect is that they are now in the Department of Corrections and are not in the community where they can harm or kill their family. And that would deter the crime. I don't know that would deter the behavior, but at some point that, you know, when they choose no longer to comply with all the opportunities they've been given, then that is all we are left with in order to keep the community safe.
Okay, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. It's fascinating listening to this professional conversation, and I'm every bit the layman here, but we were talking earlier, and I mentioned getting your thinking clear here. It's difficult for me to think clearly on this subject matter. You're going to have to forgive me. But, you know, we talked about discussion about the measuring the degree of injury. So children are incredibly resilient. Their bruises heal up. Fortunately, we forget pain, but that negative impact of the trauma that's inflicted on them never goes away and has lifelong effect on us humans. Is that taken into consideration when the judge is determining the degree of injury, or is it just bruises and broken bones and the time that the blood and air is constricted?
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger and Representative Schaffler, trying to get clear on my thinking again.
I'm ready to vote. I don't even need to think anymore. Okay. But
no, I think your question is this: is the vulnerability of the victim, a young child, taken into consideration in determining whether or not physical injury is present? Is that your question? It definitely is at issue in the sentencing phase. The vulnerability of the victim, a particularly vulnerable victim, is a factor and circumstance recognized under the guidelines where a court can elevate and aggravate a sentence outside its standard guideline range. Mm-hmm. But the definition, really, the statutory definition for physical injury, which exists in the assault statutes, it does not exist in strangulation. It is what it is. Impairment of physical condition and substantial pain. I believe probably a minor's representation of that would reflect a minor's world, but the definition would remain the same.
Thank you.
Beat this around enough. I want to get on to 71 and the other one, or we will not be getting done. You got about 30 seconds.
Oh, dear. Thank you, Co-Chair. There's a difference between deterrence effect on the first offense versus reoffense. I definitely would agree that there should be a deterrent effect for reoffense. My experience with representing individuals in domestic violence, they're not thinking of the time of the occurrence. And so the point of it is, can you do something after the first one that will be a deterrent? And I believe that's possible. Merely elevating something to a felony would not, in my view, be a deterrent for the very first offense. With respect to the definition of prior conviction, I would agree with counsel's statement that picking up some of the crimes in 2971 might make good sense. But again, what I'm hearing people say is they're concerned about those who offend, are punished, and do it again. And if that's what everyone intends to pick up, then there needs to be some adjustment to the language.
Do you want to stay up for the next bill, too, and make any comments on it?
I can.
Okay.
Or answer questions.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2940 and open a public hearing on 2971. And Gail, you were signed up for that too.
I'll just say.
So go ahead and kind of go into that. But before you do, staff, would you talk to us a little bit about what you viewed in this?
Yes, thank you, Chair Krieger. Members of the committee, and I'll try to focus on the differences between these two bills. This likewise would raise the crime of strangulation from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony, but it would do it only in particular cases. And the cases enumerated are if the crime was committed in the presence of a belated minor child, if the defendant uses, attempts, or threatens the use of a deadly or dangerous weapon during the commission of the crime, if the defendant causes physical injury, if the defendant has a previous conviction for strangulation, if the person has a previous conviction for assault or menacing, and the victim is the same in both the previous conviction and now in the present instance, or if the person has at least three previous convictions for either assault or menacing.
Okay, any comments?
Chair Krieger and Barker, the only thing that I noted when I was reviewing this bill is that this bill does not have a crime seriousness listed as part of the bill. And so it is kind of hard to compare those things when we're talking about a fiscal, because ultimately that ends up driving the bus as far as how much this ultimately is going to end up costing. If it is made a 6, which would mirror the felony assault 4 statute, then you're looking at, again, most people would be put on probation, and only people that are an A, B, C, or D on the guidelines would be looking at a Department of Corrections sentence on the first offense. But it does mirror that language. But it does start with it being a misdemeanor for the first offense, unless any of those things occurred. I think one thing I did want to point out is under, going back for one second, House Bill 2940, that someone potentially could be eligible to reduce their felony to a misdemeanor if they qualified under the statute. And so that is always out there for anybody that behaves well and comports with the statute that.
Chair Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'll just incorporate prior comments made on 2971. We think it's a good step for calibration and for aggravating the offense. I mean, if you have these other factors and conditions in there, it's definitely a more serious crime.
So. Committee, I want to get on the other bill. Representative Barker, I think you and I need together with staff. My preference right now is with 2940, and if we need to do any tweaking, Representative Galtzer, could you get together with maybe staff from what you've heard? I know you've been taking notes, and then because this is one I'd like to get out of the committee. Thank you for your testimony.
You.
And I'll close the public hearing on 2971. And there's been some people that have been patient sitting back there. Open a public hearing on 2824.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 2824 creates a new crime of trafficking in bicycles with a destroyed or altered serial number. This would be punishable by a maximum of 30 days imprisonment, a $1,250 fine, or both.
Okay, Representative Galtzer, you're on this one too, and let's have Jonathan Matten and where's the officer Pete Dunn come up?
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Representative Sarah Galtzer from House District 16 in Corvallis. Thank you for taking the time today to hear House Bill 2824, which deals with the issue of bicycle theft. This is an issue that was brought to my attention by my constituent, Pete Dunn, who's a Corvallis police officer. And he first raised this issue to me actually in 2006. So I'm pleased that he has the opportunity today to share his concerns with you. And I will turn it over to Officer Dunn.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. As Representative Galtzer mentioned, I'm Pete Dunn, obviously employed with the City of Corvallis Police Department, and having been so, noticed criminal activity involving serial numbers and how they get very quickly obliterated by a criminal when they have stolen a bike. So upon that, I just started thinking about how it could be resolved, looking at other states. I noticed just a real quick non-exhaustive search of other states. I noticed there's other six other states that have similar legislation already in place. So this wouldn't be nothing new. It's not something that we're going to be having to draft up some kind of strange new language. So, and as it stands now, a criminal can simply take a bicycle and then within seconds take a metal file and destroy that serial number, making it virtually unrecognizable. And when law enforcement would contact that individual, maybe after a call for service or something along those lines, or just out on the street, you have no way to identify that bicycle versus the thousands other that are made by the manufacturer. And that's strictly the reason the manufacturer puts a serial number on a bicycle, is to help identify it as the, you know, individual bike that it is, versus, you know, the thousands of other Trek, whatever, 1500s that are created each year. Currently, Oregon doesn't have a law that addresses this. The closest we have is theft of, like, lost or mislaid property, or theft by receiving. But neither one of those really address this crime and don't allow us to remove the property from the presence and the possession of the criminal. And bicycles are used extensively throughout the criminal community. Oftentimes, they're suspended drivers or don't have the means to purchase vehicles. Bicycles afford the criminal the ability to travel in areas and get away from law enforcement, that we can't pursue them in vehicles, in motor vehicles, that is, and provides them the escape routes that they desire, quieter, easier for them to operate. They're also a form of money that the criminal uses, as they get passed around quite a bit between criminals for exchange of illicit drugs, other stolen property. And that kind of creates a self-perpetuating situation to where a criminal may need, you know, his next round of drugs or whatever the case may be. He goes, steals a bike, destroys the serial number, and then passes it off in exchange for his drugs. Just within the past 4 years, and this is just within the city limits of Corvallis, and this is to include Oregon State University, over 1,200 bicycles were stolen at an estimated value of $690,000. So that's just within Corvallis, within the 4 years. So if you multiply that, you know, you can do the math with all the communities within Oregon. So it quickly becomes in the multi-million dollar range of property loss to individuals of Oregon. This law is not intended to punish the law-abiding citizen, the one that may have purchased a bicycle at a garage sale or some other means that is passed to him. It puts in there the culpable mental state of knowingly that there is some knowledge that this serial number has been altered or destroyed on this bicycle. It also doesn't punish or provide any stipulations for those who create or build their own bikes. That seems to be growing in number recently. These bicycles generally don't have a serial number ever established for them. It's either maybe they may apply an owner-applied number, like a their own driver's license number or something like that, but it's not a true serial number applied by the manufacturer, and therefore would not fall under this law and would not be an issue. And finally, this law would give the law enforcement the necessary tools in order to take the bicycle from the criminal and from the person possessing it in order to remove it from them and place it into forfeiture, and ultimately it would be destroyed as the law is currently written. But without that, law enforcement, when we contact somebody on the street, we simply have to let them leave, knowing that you've contacted somebody who is transient in nature and he's riding a $1,200 mountain bike. You know that he cannot afford that bike. That bike has a destroyed serial number. I have no other recourse but to allow him to leave with that bicycle. So that's why I've worked with Representative Gelster on this for so many years. We've tried, and I appreciate you guys considering this today, and I hope you pass it on to the full House.
Okay, do you have some testimony?
Sure. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, my name is Jonathan Manton, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And in general, we support the concept of this bill, but we do have some concerns. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance is a nonprofit whose mission is to promote bicycling and improve bicycling conditions in Oregon. It was founded in 1990, and we've grown to about 5,000 members now, as well as 19 staff people and hundreds of volunteers. The concerns we have with this, and again, we're you know, very happy to support efforts to crack down on bike theft, as Officer Dunn reported. It's obviously a huge problem, and so we would support those kind of efforts. But the concerns with this bill in particular are some of the ones that I think Officer Dunn raised, that there are lots of instances where an individual would lawfully be in possession of a bike without a serial number or with a damaged serial number. And so there just may be enforcement concerns. The bike could have been repainted so that you wouldn't be able to see the serial number. There might be accessories that have damaged it. They could have been in an accident. And as Officer Dunn said, some bikes don't have serial numbers in the first place. And the homemade, home-built industry is growing. Those custom bikes oftentimes don't have a serial number at all. So there just may be some confusion there. And we would like to work further maybe with Officer Dunn and Representative Gelser and others to maybe address some of these concerns if we can.
Representative Garrett, do you have a question?
In response to that concern, Jonathan, maybe my criminal law colleagues can remind me of how the mental state requirement works, but the way the bill is written, it says you commit the offense if you knowingly buy, sell, receive, dispose of, conceal, or have in your possession the bicycle from which the number's been removed for the purpose of concealing or misrepresenting the identity of the bicycle. So if you're only committing the offense if you do this with the knowledge that the number was concealed for the purpose of concealing or misrepresenting the bike's identity, I think your problem is resolved, because that's not going to apply to somebody who may simply have knowledge that the serial number has been removed but doesn't know why. Does that make sense?
Yes, Representative Garrett and members of the committee, that makes sense. I think the concern would be of people maybe being charged or kind of being, you know, if I've got a bike and it has no serial number on it, it just kind of looks, you know, as if you may be guilty of this crime, and not necessarily, you may not be guilty of the intent, but you may be, you know, approached for, and are charged with the crime when you were lawfully in possession of the bike.
Representative Barker.
Along those lines, that you might have been in an accident, you've got a scratched up serial number, the concern would be this might make it look like you stole the bike.
Okay, Representative
Barker. My question is, so we find a bike to the file serial number, and then you seize it and destroy it, why wouldn't you try to raise that number?
Why would you not try to raise it?
Raise the number so you could possibly get it back to the owner.
That is a possibility that you might be able to do. It's not something that local law enforcement really has the ability to do. I know our department doesn't do that with the property. If they cannot establish a direct owner, just basically upon how it's brought in, then it is scheduled for destruction or put into public auction.
I used to be in your business, and we used to have, it's motor vehicles or motorcycles. We'd find out where somebody said, well, it tipped over, and that's why the number scraped. And with it, you can put acid on those. When a number is stamped into metal at the factory, it compresses the metal under those numbers, so that metal is actually denser where the numbers are. And so then you put acid that eats away the metal, then those numbers kind of rise up out of there, and you can recover that number again. And that was a fairly standard procedure that was even done at our local level. And but anyway, I would rather see if we could have some way to get the bike back to the owner than just saying this isn't your bike because it's scuffed up and destroy it. But
President Schaffer, did you have a question?
Yeah, I like the idea of public, thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the idea of a public auction, put some kind of stamp on it showing it's went through the law enforcement system and then sell it and get some money. But I think probably what happened is the unscrupulous seller tried to tell the unwitting buyer that it was filed off, but the buyer had his earbuds in his ear and didn't hear him saying it.
But I think we can maybe get this worked up a bit.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm sorry I'm wasting so much of our time, valuable time today.
I would probably guess you need to get together a little bit more. Probably the bill needs a little bit more work. Willing to do that?
I'm willing to do that, Co-Chair.
Okay. Committee, you got anything else on? Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2824. Is there any other business staff before the committee? And we're adjourned.